call the meeting to order and I guess take the opportunity to speak to you for just a minute about what we've all been thinking about for months, almost years, I guess, at this point. But we've now moved beyond campaigns and elections and given me a moment to think. And it's in terms of what we do, I think we are responsible to look within ourselves as leaders, and whether that's in the workplace, at home, or in public service, it's really time to look to decision making as a practice of getting facts, thinking about how our decisions might impact others, and making a decision and then implementing that decision. And none of that process has anything to do with rhetoric, playing on people's fears and anger. And in order for all of us to come together to go back to a process of making good decisions and mending a clearly separated society, I think we need to look to ourselves and we need to be good leaders. So with that, welcome to the port meeting this morning. And I need a motion and second to grant a leave of absence to Commissioner Pierce, who is out of town.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. And I need a motion and second for approval of the minutes of the commission meeting of October 12th.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? That motion carries. And now I'll ask for the executive director report.
Well, thank you very much. And for those of you who are attending your first port meeting, and I see a few unfamiliar faces out there, the executive director's report is a regular feature of the agenda packet that goes out. It's a formal document that goes out to the commissioners and others. And then I just take advantage of this opportunity to make a few comments about things that have occurred here over the course of the last month or so that are significant. One thing to note, we're doing a little experiment today and live streaming the commission meeting. So some of our employees, no doubt, are watching or listening or trying to. We'll get some feedback on how this works, but it's actually an exciting development, and I think for us could lead to live streaming other meetings here as well and making them available to the public, which I think would be a great thing. The airport is not the easiest place to get to at this hour of the morning for a public meeting. I do also want to acknowledge the safety champions whose photos are being circulated up on the screen behind me. And as a reminder, on the back table, you'll find an evacuation map if you want to take a look. And in the event of an emergency, port staff will escort everyone in the room through those doors, down the hall to stairwell one, and out to the gathering area next to the north lot, which is across the road from the central utility plant, which is actually right out this window. And I'd like to call on Stan Waters for this month's safety message.
Thanks, Bill. Steve, you want to pull up the slide?
And you want to get your microphone close to you there, so the green light.
Can you hear me?
Trying to.
I think they're both dead.
Projected. Well, that's maybe because they're not plugged in. Yeah, there you go. Good.
Great. Thanks, Bill. As part of our continued pursuit of safety excellence here at the port, we are realigning our safety committee structure and functions to drive decision-making down to the grassroots of the port, where employees and departments can focus on safety issues that are specific to their work environment. Our hope is that this move will empower our employees to, who are experts, to help us make safety a foundational element of our organization. Safety committees are a great way to instill a sense of ownership in employees and strengthen an organization's safety culture. As you'll see in the chart on the screen, our goal is to develop an employee and discipline-focused structure to drive safety throughout the culture, giving each operating department direct involvement in and responsibility for safety improvements in their specific areas. We also have an additional goal, and that is really to empower our employees. And what we hope is that when committee members see the positive impact that they're going to make on workplace safety, that that will motivate them to make even greater improvements in their respective areas. And our goal right now is to have all of this operational by December 1st. Any questions?
I Great. Think not. Thank you for the report. Yeah.
Yep.
So I want to recognize veterans here at the port this Friday. It'll be Veterans Day, and we have many. Actually, we have some who are currently serving in the National Guard. And here you see a selection, as a matter of fact. We're very proud of them. And we're running an ad honoring veterans in local minority-owned newspaper. And also a new tradition at the Port HQ is a rotating slideshow on our atrium screen, which is in the center part of the building, for all port employees and any of their family members who've served in the armed forces. And it's really kind of a treat, actually, when you walk by that screen, because you can't miss it to see that. The 29th Annual Condé Nast Reader's Choice Awards survey has recognized PDX as the second best domestic airport in the United States behind Indianapolis. Some 300,000 travelers weighed in with the magazine's Reader's Choice Awards 2016. This is a position that we're somewhat unfamiliar with, but I'm sure we'll regain our top spot soon. We've received two FAA grants, significant grants. The first is an Airport Improvement Program grant of $11.6 million, and that'll help fund the reconstruction of approximately 3,300 feet of taxiway B center, including exits B3, B5, and B8, holding bays, and intersection of taxiway B and M. This is, you know, these are just kind of meat and potato projects that are so important to the operation of an airport. We do a lot of pavement here, a lot of pavement management, and these grants are terrific, because otherwise we would, of course, be laying those additional charges onto the carriers. And two other elements of the project include widening the taxiway shoulders from 15 to 30 feet to meet airport design standards, and replacing and installing drains under the taxiway to meet other requirements. The second grant was part of the FAA's voluntary airport low-emission and zero-emissions airport vehicle programs. Our airport received $5.7 million to purchase and install 27 preconditioned air units at passenger gates. This is very important. Plane pulls up to the passenger gate, plugs in, and without these, the conditioning of the aircraft is a pretty marginal affair and not very pleasant if you're either working on the plane or flying on the plane. So this is a great step. The plan builds on efforts to address climate change and support clean energy innovation, because if they weren't doing this, they'd be running their alternative power units. And so this is a really nice step forward for us. We were fortunate to be able to inaugurate the Cathay Pacific cargo freighter service between Portland and Hong Kong last week. Everything went off without a hitch. We had a lovely event for them in the evening with a lot of the local freight forwarding community. And the next day, Their plane showed up on time, which was very nice because all of their senior executives were there to greet it. The governor came down. They had about 50 tons of cargo, which is really substantial for them. And it turned out to be one of the few beautiful days we've experienced here in some time, which was also nice because obviously the event was outdoors. This is starting as a twice weekly scheduled freighter service. So I think we're talking Tuesdays or Wednesdays and Saturday.
Thursday, Saturday.
Okay. And they clearly intend to increase the number of frequencies. I could see an additional frequency somewhere in the next 6 months or so. And I kept talking about two, and one of their senior people kept talking about four. So they really want to see this marketplace grow, and I think they will. For Oregon exporters, this is just a tremendous opportunity because it takes the truck time off of air freight exports to Asia. Several of us have been to their base in Hong Kong, where they have an extraordinary state-of-the-art center for the distribution of their cargo. Almost none of it is really intended for Hong Kong. It's going to points beyond, to places like Vietnam, to China, and to really all points in Asia. And so for agricultural exporters, for our good friends at Nike, the air soles, which I think comprised 15 tons of the 50 that were going out that day, Intel is certainly a possible consumer of this service. And I was mistaken in describing it as an all-export service because on our way out of the terminal, there were three pallets that I was told were imports. So they had come from Hong Kong to Los Angeles and then up to Portland and loaded off. And what were they? They were iPhones that were being trucked up to Seattle. So I think we'll probably see some more of this. I also really want to call out the efforts of the state in supporting this. This has been about a two-year undertaking, and it's a major commitment from Cathay to close one hub and literally move it here to Portland. But it meets obviously the growing demand to move a wide range of commodities from the Pacific Northwest and the United States to various parts of Asia. And in support of this important service recruitment, the state of Oregon is providing a $250,000 grant funded in part with Oregon State Lottery funds and administered by the Oregon Business Development Department to help defray some of Cathay's initial operating costs. Because when they start a service like this, there are some one-time-only expenses that are involved in starting the service. And you know, these are expensive services. The plane itself is, I think, the retail price. It's a brand new 747-800 aircraft, which probably retails for $300 million. So it's an expensive proposition. It serves exactly two U.S. markets, Los Angeles and Portland. They fuel the plane here on its way to Anchorage and then to Hong Kong, and it's about a $120,000 bill. That takes, I think, a tremendous commitment, and this money from the state was really helpful in closing the deal. Alaska Airlines is launching service to Newark on November 10th, which is really very exciting. Newark is primarily a Star Alliance hub, so this will give Alaska flyers a real option into New York. And I think it's safe to say that our options into New York now are really diverse, which is great. So people can get there in any number of different ways. This will be tremendous. Iceland Air has recently announced their 2017 schedule. They will now offer up to five flights a week from Portland during next summer's high season. Currently, they're flying two times per week. I saw their plane out there yesterday, and they will close for the season this year after the first of the year. So Just always amazing to me that there is a market for people flying to Reykjavik in January, but apparently there is. I know this having talked to them, they're very pleased with how the service has gone here. November 14th is London Day. We have a large group of people traveling with Delta to be in London for a major air service development conference. And I think plans are going very well for the startup of the London service. We have a great team working with the local travel community, Travel Portland, Travel Oregon, and others. And you're just going to be seeing a lot more evidence of that, both in advertising and events here locally. Because David Zelke is directly involved in this, you can imagine that you're going to see a lot of hats. If you don't know David, David's a hat fan, so there will be a lot of PDX, LHR hats and other related promotional activities. Southwest Airlines has indicated to us that they are exiting the Portland Orange County market on January 15, 2017. Orange County is one of the very few airports in the country that has restricted access, and I think it may be the only one in the country that is actually restricted for noise purposes. It's a very unusual thing, and so that makes the slots into Orange County incredibly competitive. And so we lose that. We do still have service to Orange County, but it now won't be flown by Southwest Airlines. We welcome a new food cart to PDX this week. Mowberry will serve smoothies, chai bowls with lots of healthy add-ons and toppings. And, you know, the cart program has really been a great way for small retailers to kind of put their little toe in the water and figure out if this is a place that works for them. And I think it's been a great opportunity, I think, also for the airport family, passengers, but also all of us who work out here to try something new every day. Because if you work out here 365 days a year, the regular offerings, you can get a little tired of that. And so this is a really a nice way to add some spice and also develop future potential customers and tenants of the port. We have a call out now for applicants for the Mentor Protege program, which is really one of the most exciting programs that we have, where we work with young up-and-coming contractors who would like to do business with the port and with others, frankly, but who need, you know, some help, frankly, in establishing their business and understanding what it takes. Many of the largest contractors in our community have stepped forward to participate in this and to be mentors. And I had the occasion here about a month ago to go to the monthly OAMI meeting, the Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, and seated next to a woman who was a graduate 2 years ago. And she got up and basically told her story as a mentor in this program. She has a tile business. It's she and her son, and said she could never be in this business but for the Mentor Protege program. She just learned so much. And this is not a game of patsy. These are very tough conversations about what it takes to run a business. She said for her, it was just meant everything to her. I leaned over quietly and said, "And have you done any business at the port?" Because I didn't know. And she said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, we have," which, of course, I love to hear. So it's a terrific program, and we're now seeking applications for the next round. On October 25th, we completed two more of our statewide visits, which is a part of our 125th year anniversary outreach. These events have been really well attended and well received. It's just a good excuse for us, frankly, to get out and talk to people about what we do, because so much of what we do is, frankly, obscure and under the radar. And so it's been great. I was down in Salem. Curtis went down to Eugene And folks appear to have a tremendous interest in the port and port-related activities. And so it was great. At Hillsborough, we had an open house. Hillsborough Airport, we had an open house. We hosted 900 attendees on October 22nd at the annual Hillsborough Airport open house. This is important because we're about to begin the master plan out there, and it's just a good way to reach out and let people know how they can participate in that master plan. You'll recall that we just completed the Troutdale master plan. Hillsborough's will be exponentially more challenging just because it's a bigger and more complicated operation. So that concludes my remarks.
Thank you. Questions or comments? I know from attending the Cathay Pacific event last week that the Cathay Pacific folks, including the CEO of the cargo division, were very complimentary of the team here at the port that put together that deal. So thanks to all of you who were part of that. I'm going to ask Cindy now to do the next item, which is the external audit. I'm sorry. We do. We need a motion and second to approve the executive director's report.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. It carries. Now, Cindy, we'll have the audit presentation.
Morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Although government entities like the port are not subject to legislative requirements like Sarbanes-Oxley, we think it's prudent to be transparent in presenting our financial results to the governing body as well as to the general public, whether it's technically required or not. So Bob Burkett, the port's controller, will be presenting you with our financial results for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2016. Following Bob's report, we'll have PricewaterhouseCoopers partner Mike McBride come up and discuss certain elements regarding our audit. So with that, Bob.
Thanks, Cindy. Good morning.
Morning.
So we have loaded you up with documents. You have four sets of documents in front of you. You have the port's audited financial statements, which is the blue cover. You have a couple of white cover documents, which are the report on passenger facility charges, as well as the report on federal awards. And then you have PricewaterhouseCoopers communications report with the bright colors on the front. And in the back of that, you'll also find three management representation letters that we provided to them as part of their audit. For those in the audience, we have extra copies of these documents on the table in the back of the room, and we'll also post the audited financials on our website this week, hopefully later today. My review of the financial statements will be at a high level. We'll focus on the two major financial components, the general fund and PDX, and on each one we'll talk about operating revenues, operating expenses excluding depreciation, operating income before depreciation, which is the mathematical sum of the previous two, non-operating net income, and working capital. Before I start walking through the financials, I'd like to take a moment to talk about an accounting pronouncement that took effect in fiscal 2015 because I'm going to make numerous references to it throughout the presentation. Governmental Accounting Standards Board Statement Number 68, which I'll call GASB 68, was new pension accounting guidance that went into effect in 2015, and it required us to bring a new item onto our balance sheet that previously we only disclosed in the notes to the financial statements. It also has changed how we calculate and record pension expense on the income statement. And rather than basing our expense on our annual required contributions to PERS, it is now based on changes in our net pension liability on our balance sheet. And because of the GASB rules, the required timing of implementation, and the timing of our reporting from PERS, the Oregon Supreme Court decision that overturned a significant amount of the 2013 legislative PERS reform, that was not reflected in the fiscal 2015 numbers for either the port or any other Oregon PERS employers. So as a result, we started out with a net pension asset last year rather than a liability and had to record $19 million worth of negative expense as expected in fiscal 16, these numbers turned around. We brought liability onto our balance sheet, and we recorded $29 million worth of expense last year for GASB 68. Unfortunately, volatility is the new reality imposed on us by our friends at the GASB. However, now that we have a pension liability on our books that reflects more or less the current status of PERS, famous last words, I do not expect to see this kind of volatility again. It's important to note that pension expense under GASB 68 is not a cash expense. It doesn't impact our airline rates and charges. It doesn't impact our billing to the Corps of Engineers for contract dredging. And it doesn't even impact our legal budget. So I'll also add bond rating agencies understand this. They've said they're not going to downgrade anyone on the basis of GASB 68 alone. So as understanding of this gets out there, you'll see more and more numbers excluding GASB 68, more and more caveats in financial reporting. So that'll be my theme today. There we go. So I'll start out with the general fund, which is labeled marine and other in the blue audit report. And the same numbers I'll cover here are start on page 9 in that blue report, if you care to look at that later. And for slides that reflect the impact of GASB 68 expense, I will also show the numbers excluding GASB 68. So our first slide shows general fund operating revenues for fiscal 15 and 16, as well as the 16 budget there in yellow. As you can see, our fiscal 16 operating revenues were a bit higher than the prior year, but still about $15 million below budget in fiscal 16. The primary reason for that variance is the timing of land sales. We had about $11 million in land sales that were delayed out to fiscal 17. We also were about $4 million below budget as a result of lower activity at our marine terminals during the year. And there were no land sales in fiscal 15, which is why that's the lowest bar of all there. In fiscal 17, we're anticipating about $80 million in operating revenues with $28 million worth of land sales. And we've already had over $9 million in land sales closed in the first quarter of fiscal 2017. So we're on track. So then this slide shows general fund operating expense before depreciation for the same time period. And you can see that we're about $17 million below budget for operating expenses for 2016. However, since GASB 68 impacts are not included in the legal budget, if we exclude them, as represented here by my lovely blue, light blue shading, it gives us a better comparison of actual to budget. So the resulting variance of $28 million between our fiscal 16 actuals of $51 million and the budget of $79 million, $11 million of that was cost of property. Now, again, it was due to delayed land sales that'll occur in fiscal 17. Marine operating expenses were below budget by about $7 million due to lower activity. Our environmental expenses related to the harbor were down about $6.5 million, primarily due to delays in the timing of the process in the harbor. And the support services area's expenses were down about $3 million on the year, largely as a result of providing more capital support, and that reduces operating expenses by transferring that expense into capital projects that they're supporting. So now we move on to general fund operating income before depreciation, or OIBD. It's simply the mathematical result of the operating expenses being subtracted from those operating revenues that we reviewed. OIBD was better than budget here, but recall again, GASB 68 is not included in the budget. So if we exclude GASB 68 here in the light blue, we see the impacts of that. And by backing that negative expense out in fiscal 15, you see that leaves us with a slightly negative OIBD. But in fiscal 2016, as we back out the regular expense, the positive expense, gives us a pretty dramatic improvement up to almost $12 million in OIBD, $13.5 million better than budget. And that improvement really is spread across pretty much all of the general fund lines of business, as we went over in the last two slides. And next year in the fiscal 2017 budget, we're anticipating about $7 million in OIBD. So now we have a slide that shows general fund non-operating. Non-operating revenues and expenses primarily include property taxes, interest income on our investments, as well as interest expense on our long-term debt. In fiscal 16, the $21 million also reflects the closing of a lease restructuring for Portland Bulk Terminals at Terminal 5 and a restructuring payment that we received of approximately $9 million. So the $10 million budget variance that you see there was primarily driven by that Portland Bulk Terminals payment, as well as about $1 million in higher interest income resulting from our slightly increasing interest rate environment that we're getting into. So here we have the bottom line for the general fund, which for 2016, it represents our operating income before depreciation, less our depreciation, plus our non-operating income. Again, these are the numbers with GASB 68, and then here are the numbers without the impacts of GASB 68. So you can see that the positive variances that we've discussed on the prior slides have allowed us to come out $20 million better than the budget approximately. And as we've discussed, about half of this was driven by non-operating, and about half of this was driven by reduced operating expenses. Next year, we are anticipating positive net income of about $1.5 million in our legal budget. So this is our last general fund slide, and this is our working capital balance, which is sometimes referred to loosely as the general fund bank account. Working capital is a liquidity measurement that takes our current assets like cash, investments, and trade receivables, and reduces that by the liabilities we know we have to pay in the next year. So we have a significant positive working capital balance of $176 million for the general fund. But as you can see in the yellow bar, $139 million of that is really already spoken for. That is the amount that's already obligated to pay for capital projects and other restricted reserves. So things aren't as rosy as they appear. So now we'll switch on to PDX. And here we have PDX operating revenues. Passenger traffic is the single biggest driver for aviation business, and we had a record 17.6 million passengers during fiscal 2016, which was an increase of 1.5 million passengers, or 9.2% versus the record we had set in the prior year. So this drove total operating revenues up 12.6% versus 2015 to $232 million. This was due both to increased parking and concession revenues driven by the increased activity, as well as a one-time project write-off that we billed to the airlines that I'll explain a little further on the next slide. It's also worth noting that fiscal 2016 was the first year in our new 10-year lease extension with the airlines. And next year, we're anticipating about $228 million in operating revenues based off a forecast of 18.4 million total passengers. So this shows airport operating expenses excluding depreciation. Again, many of the variances here are impacted by GASB 68 non-cash expense. So if we back those impacts out, we can see the comparison without GASB 68, and you can see that fiscal 16 operating expenses excluding depreciation compare more reasonably. The $127 million in actual expense reflects nearly $11 million in expense for the one-time write-off of terminal balancing design costs that we determined did not have a future benefit after some project changes that were made in response to an air carrier's fleet changes. As I alluded to on the previous slide, this write-off is billed in its entirety to the signatory carriers. So we had $11 million in additional revenues to offset the $11 million in additional expense that you see here. Excluding GASB 68 and excluding the unanticipated one-time terminal balancing adjustment, operating expenses for PDX were actually slightly below budget, primarily as a result of vacant positions during the year. So here we have PDX operating income before depreciation. Our OIBD was $87 million when you include the impacts of GASB 68. And as the broken record goes on, we'll exclude that here. and show the impact of backing that out. Operating income before depreciation now compares pretty favorably with budget. We're about $6 million improved, and that's primarily driven by higher revenues from the higher than projected passenger counts. Here is PDX non-operating income and expenses. For PDX, that includes passenger facility charges, or PFCs, customer facility charges, or CFCs, interest income on investment, interest expense on long-term debt, and some other smaller items. It's worth noting that unlike the general fund, PDX does not receive any property tax dollars. So our PDX non-operating revenue was about $5 million better than budget this year, and that's really the result of higher than budgeted PFC and CFC revenues, again, driven by the higher enplanements. Additionally, in that blue bar is reflected about $29 million of interest expense on our long-term debt. We have about $610 million worth of revenue bonds outstanding at the end of the year. So at last, we come to PDX net income, again, the bottom line for PDX. So this is, again, the combination of OIBD, less depreciation, plus the non-operating income. And now if we take that and we back out our GASB 68 impacts, you'll see that the fiscal 16 results contributed pretty well to the bottom line with $50 million in PDX net income, exceeding the budget by about $16 million. Again, largely the result of that higher passenger activity driving higher concessions and parking and PFC and CFC revenues, as well as some lower expenses due to staff vacancies and slightly lower allocated central services costs from the administrative department.
Can I ask you a question about, you keep going back to the GASB 68 and the unfunded portion of the pension commitment. Will that number stay at that level indefinitely?
It is
a policy choice, or
so it is actuarially based, and so it will change every year. However, without a significant change to PERS, I would not expect a significant change in that liability. And so now our expense, you know, this blue bar will get much, much smaller in the future, hopefully to the point where I don't have to call it out. I would hope that it will approximate what we're actually paying to PERS, but so far we haven't seen that given where we're at in the implementation.
And that closure will occur because there's a decision made at the state level as to how much is going to be funded from our money, as opposed to us making a decision that we're going to close that gap today.
Yeah, the way the PERS system works is every 2 years they adjust the employer rates.
Right.
And that is done on an actuarial basis that will, over a 20-year period of time, fully fund the obligations of the system,
right,
both the benefits that are being earned as well as the benefits that have been earned in the past that have not yet been funded.
Right. Okay.
Two things will close it, actually. One is that Tier 1 members of PERS get old and
go away.
Yeah. But that, you know, that bubble is substantial, and it's going to take a long time. But I suspect that there are some things the legislature could do from a policy perspective to get after this. And I think particularly given the vote on Measure 97, they'll probably try to do something. It's going to be a struggle. But I think it's also worth noting public pensions are an issue in virtually every jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. One of the things that makes Oregon unique is that we have a longstanding policy here of fully funding our obligations. And so that's one of the reasons why the employer rates are as high as they are, because we're attempting to fund them fully. And the PERS board has adopted, I think, a pretty thoughtful strategy, which basically says they're going to collar the increases so that in any 1 year you won't see an increase that is designed to cover the whole gap. They basically step up to that so that people can budget properly, and that's one of the reasons why our increase for the next year is not greater than it is, because of the collared increase.
Yeah, our collared increase will be approximately 4 percentage points, additional percentage points to our current employer rates. And I would expect that without significant change in the system or some really great returns, we will see similar increases over a couple of biennia.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
So it was another great year for PDX. We had record employments, we had strong financial performance, and our AA- bond rating with S&P was reaffirmed again. In next year's budget, we're anticipating a net income of about $42 million, again, excluding the impacts of GASB 68. So here we have the working capital. The bank account for PDX. Our fiscal 16 balance of $329 million reflects a buildup of working capital in the construction funds after we wound down from our previous capital program that began back in 2008. And as we continue moving forward with our current capital program, we're going to expect to see this balance decrease as more of these large projects get underway. Again, the yellow bar represents the amount of that working capital balance that's already obligated for construction and for debt service, as well as for our operating reserve. So now we will move from audited financials to a couple of slides on some of the PFC report or the PWC reports, the first one being on PFCs. As part of their audit, PWC provides a separate report on the passenger facility charge program and on internal controls over compliance, which they'll discuss in their presentation. Passenger facility charges, or PFCs, are that $4.50 per ticket charge that's assessed on in-plane passengers. The airlines collect it and remit it to airports, and we get to spend these PFC revenues on FAA-approved projects. This slide shows the last 2 years' worth of passenger facility charge collections in the blue bars. That averages over $33 million a year in revenues to the port, or to the airport in particular. And the yellow bars show PFC expenditures for each year, which is primarily about $14 million worth of debt service, plus amounts used to fund project costs. As you can see, we've spent less than half of our collections for the last couple of years, but that will change soon as we get more approved capital work underway. And now we have a slide showing federal awards port-wide during the last 3 years. The total funding varies by year, largely because it's a function of what projects do we have underway at a point in time and the eligibility of those projects for certain types of funding. The two most noteworthy types of federal funding that we received recently are the FAA Airport Improvement Program, which is in the Navy bar. The majority of that work in fiscal 16 went to fund PDX taxiway and access control project improvements. And then the Army Corps of Engineers funding of contract dredging. It's a different type of federal award than our grants, but as you can see here in silver, it's quite sizable. As part of their audit, PWC has drafted a separate report regarding our compliance in fiscal 16 with the Office of Management and Budget Uniform Guidance pertaining to federal funding awards, and they'll discuss that in their presentation. I thought I would point out that PWC did have a finding in their Uniform Guidance audit this year pertaining to the fact that we had not completed a physical inventory of our fixed assets within the last 2 years of our or within 2 years of our previous inventory. And while I don't want to diminish the fact that there's a requirement to perform a physical inventory of fixed assets that have received physical or federal funding, I do want to point out that we were less than a month out of compliance at our year end, and the risk of runways, pavements, and structures disappearing without our knowledge is pretty low. However, we have implemented a new process to isolate and inventory just our fixed assets that received federal funding on a two-year cycle. So that concludes, at long last, what I have to say about fiscal 16 performance. So I'll pause in case there are any more questions.
Any questions?
Quick question. The finding on the absence of the inventory of assets,
yes,
was that from the previous report as well, or was that the first time?
That's the first time.
Okay.
We were in compliance last year. We were a month out of compliance by this year.
Great. Thank you.
Anything else? Thanks.
So now Mike McBride will come up to present his report and required communications. And while he comes up here, I'll take a moment to point out that we have Ian Fleming, the quality review partner with PwC, as well as Clifford Fan, the audit manager. We had a really good audit team this year, and Mike, along with Ian and Clifford, headed that team up.
Morning, everyone.
Morning.
So thank you. By the way, this will be the document that I'll be speaking to. I think everybody's got a handout of that one. So thank you again. It's a real pleasure to be here to continue to working with the Port of Portland. I've been doing this audit for 8 years now, I think. And I very much appreciate the opportunity to continue to work with you. One of the reasons why I wanted to have Bob introduce Ian is, I think about succession planning for me, as often other organizations do. Ian is an assurance partner based here in Portland. He's got good experience in terms of common, similar clients. So he's done other ports and other GASB clients. And so I think, as I think about succession planning, I think he'd be a good one to be in front of this microphone at some point in time in the future. So with that, we are done. So if you flip to page three, the executive summary. We're done with all our deliverables. We've issued unmodified opinions on the A-133 reporting and on the financial statements. Unmodified is a common language for clean opinion, okay? The other things I want to talk to you about are just call out some of the things that are of matters that my profession thinks are important to have with boards, as well as just call out some of the more significant accounting and auditing areas that we deal with as we execute on the audit that I thought would be a good topic for everybody to hear. So if you flip to page four, you've heard me talk about this in the past in terms of fraud. As a profession, we've really been focused in on this really since some of the noteworthy scandals in the early 2000s. So we're required to seek out and detect material instances of fraud, understand where the incentives and the pressures are, understand the risks that exist either in the business model or in the control environment. And we do that, and we take it very seriously. We inquire of a lot of folks throughout the organization. We do detailed testing designed to look at areas where can management exercise some bias, where can they go around controls and circumvent the control environment. We do detailed testing of journal entries and revenue transactions and the like, and I'm pleased to report that we're not aware. And by the way, we've inquired of this committee during our planning process and throughout, and we're not aware of any instances of fraud, which is always a good thing to report. On page five, in terms of significant accounting policies and practices, I thought Bob summarized it really well. You know, when I think about significant accounting policies and practices, one of the things that I like to report up here is an element of consistency, as well as talk about any new standards that have been adopted by the port. The most significant one this year is known as GASB 72. And for those who have dealt with the financial accounting world, the non-governmental world, it really was around disclosures of leveling of investments, leveling one, two, and three. It's an element, level one being it's very marketable to get the market price of something. You can just open up a Wall Street Journal, for example, and get a market price. Level three being it's principally model-driven. And so you'll see that in the footnotes. I thought the organization was well prepared for this. We were discussing this for about a year, and there were no particular challenges to report, but I did want to report that's the most significant one. Other than that, there were no accounting policies. Even when we compare the accounting policies throughout industry and look at other similar ports, either in our portfolio or certainly out in the industry, there's nothing that I would call out that would be, I would call, atypical of an organization like the port. So the next few pages I'm going to talk about are some of the larger accounting and auditing matters that we typically do. And by the way, I would like to just thank the folks from internal audit in this perspective, right? Because one of the things that we do in order to deliver not only a quality audit, but certainly do it in a cost-efficient way, is we leverage the resources of internal audit in some of these areas. So they do provide us with support in executing some of these audit areas. So the three here on that are on page six, operating revenues, cash and investments, debt, and I'm not going to go through every one of these bulleted elements here, but as you can see, there is a lot of detailed testing that's done as we execute on the audit of these areas. When I think about revenue transactions, whether it's the airport or whether it's the marine transactions, it involves detailed confirmations, detailed testing of underlying transactions. It's confirmations of cash investments. We also look to make sure that the port is complying with its own policies around investment policies and anything that may be called out in Oregon state statutes around what you can and can't invest in. So we do also test the compliance of the port there. And when I think about debt, not only is it to make sure that the number that's been reported is certainly complete and accurate, but to the extent that there are covenants that require compliance, we also look to the compliance to make sure that the organization is complying with its debt covenants. And I'm pleased to report that there were no exceptions noted as a result of those procedures performed. On page 7, two other areas that I want to call out: interest rate swaps and environmental liabilities. And these are two areas that, when I think about fair value and estimates, these are two areas that we tend to focus in on. Not that the dollars are all that significant for the swaps, but we do look at it. It does involve some interesting calculations. We actually have some of our specialists that we use from a valuation perspective to understand and make sure that the accounting and the reporting is accurate, because it is a little bit different in GASB accounting. So we want to make sure that they get this right. And then environmental liabilities, Bob was talking a little bit about that. You know, this is an area that we spend a lot of time. We actually have, as part of our firm, environmental specialists that we bring to bear to work with your team. You know, this is an area that I'd say the port has really built a good internal control structure around, because monitoring and managing this, given the nature of the organizations, is important and it's complex. And we spend a lot of time on this every year to make sure that, one, do we understand what's going on, whether it's the Portland Harbor, where are you with statutes? Because there has been, you know, the port has been named as a potentially responsible party in a lot of areas. And we want to make sure, given that there's an obligating event, what are the potential obligations that the port would have to remediate, and to what extent? And to the extent that there isn't anything, is there a good disclosure around what's going on there? So this is an area we have spent a fair amount of time on and are very comfortable that the accounting and the reporting and the disclosures are compliant with the accounting standards. The next page on uniform guidance, I thought, again, Bob highlighted this very well. We do, you know, this is, when I think about a compliance audit and the one finding we'll talk about in a minute, you know, you either complied or you didn't, okay? And unfortunately, that's where we're at. It's a pass-fail test. So we do a lot of detailed testing, one, certainly to make sure that the numbers are right, but that compliance with, are those costs allowable? Have they spent those in accordance with either the federal regulations or in a particular cost supplement? Have they complied with all of the different non-financial things around, if they're subrecipients, cost transfers, and the like? Are all those particular compliance elements have been they comply with? The one, and I thought Bob's said it very well, is there's an equipment inventory. And if this was any other organization, given the level of fixed assets you have, I may have kind of called this something maybe a little bit more significant. But I agree with Bob and management that when you look out and can you see the runway still there, can you see the fire trucks are still there, the likelihood of loss in some of these things is very, very low. But nonetheless, being a pass-fail type test, it ends up in the report as a finding. We also looked at management's remediation plan on this, and we're very comfortable that they've got a good plan in place, and so I wouldn't expect this to be a recurring finding going forward. Page 9, I wanted to highlight, and you've probably heard me talk about this in the past, you know, most of the time I live in what's called the FASB world, which is what most businesses operate under, and FASB has been a very active board in the last 10, 15 years. GASB has been catching up, and you see that in a lot of the different standards that have been issued in the last several years. This page here are some of the standards that have been issued that will be adopted as the port goes forward in 17 and 18 and the like. I put this out here, not that I think any of these are going to have a significant impact on the port, but I put it out there just to let you know the complexity, and when I think about talking about risk to boards and audit committees and the like, you know, this is the stuff that your financial accounting team needs to deal with day in and day out. And when I look at the financial statements on how complex they continue to get, it really is important to make sure that the team is in place, the right team's in place to be able to deal with this continuing increased complexity around accounting and reporting. The one that's not on here that the Financial Accounting Standard Board has issued, but GASB is deliberating on, is leases. The port obviously engages in a number of areas where it has leases. The Financial Accounting Standard Board has issued a standard that basically will bring the operating leases, if you will, on the books, where in the past they've basically been rent expense. So these will now be treated as right-to-use assets. So you'll see a balance sheet impact on this. GASB will probably issue something in the near term on this, and this will be something that I think the governments will have a number of years to deal with, but that'll probably be the biggest one. The other one that you may hear talked about in the governmental space is around post-retirement health care benefits, post-retirement benefits. Here at the port, I don't think there's going to be a significant impact, but I've had other conversations with other GASB clients where this is a big deal. And kind of like pension accounting standards, this is different. It's a different model than what governments have been used to. The pay-as-you-go kind of booking to something a little less than the ultimate liability is a new concept, and this will be one that will be impacting a lot of governments. Here, I don't think the impact will be all that significant. So the next few pages are on our required communications, and I'm just going to hit upon a couple of them. So if I flip to page 11 on the quality of the port's financial reporting, this is one where, our job really is to report to you, certainly not only on the quality and the completeness and accurate disclosures, but certainly on the acceptability of the different accounting policies that the port has implemented and adopted. And again, while there's no necessary, particular qualitative standard that I'm going to measure this against, I will tell you that the port continues to have very good disclosures in their financial statements. It's interesting. I often have this discussion around whether they're clear or not. I mean, I think as you read through a lot of the accounting, and the accounting is really trying to get to where it's transparency, but oftentimes in that transparency, there's so much detail, it almost gets lost in what did I just read? When you look at pension footnotes and other footnotes that seem to go on for pages. But I will tell you that I think there's, when I think about what goes on here at the port, that the quality of the disclosures in the financial statements are very good. And that's the measure that I look to. On page 12, always of interest to my clients' boards is identified misstatements. So when I think about a barometer of the quality of audit, or as you assess the quality of the financial reporting team that you have here at the port, it's two areas, right? It's, okay, what did the audit find? Did the numbers change because you had an audit? And the answer here is they didn't. We had no adjustments found as a result of the audit that management booked as a result of that audit, and we have nothing that I'll call put on our score sheet, so to speak. So did we find something that management said we just don't want to book? We'll deal with that next year. Neither one of those. So again, when you think about all the different transactions, the volume of dollars that go on here, both in the airport and the marine columns, that we had no found or uncorrected misstatements. Page 13, the one area I wanted to call out, a couple areas. One, the other information and documents containing the audit financial statements. So these are where, to the extent that, my audit opinion and the audit financial statements are going to be included in other documents, we have a responsibility to understand those to make sure they're consistently in agreement, or there's nothing inconsistent with the audit financial statements. And the typical area this comes up with is bond offering. So, I know that the organization is going to be thinking about a bond transaction coming up, so we'll be associated with that. And to the extent there were prior bond offerings, obviously you've heard we've been associated with that. Disagreements with management and difficulties encountered during the audit, none. We have great cooperation for everybody up and down the chain here at the port. Throughout the organization, by the way, when you think about how we have to go out, and we did some inventory procedures, so we had to get resources in to help us find assets. We do detailed testing in the areas that involve the airport or the other grant programs, and certainly the financial team, the environmental team, and the legal team here, everybody gives us great cooperation. The other barometer area on the top of page 14, control deficiencies. Again, we look at a lot of different things here. We also understand the control environment. We do testing of internal controls, particularly as it relates to the spending of federal dollars. And I'm pleased to report we have no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies to report to this committee. And that's it. Appendix A, as Bob pointed out, we are required to share with you the written representations that management gives us. You'll see that, you know, I feel like that letter increases by a paragraph or two every year. But these are the areas that, you know, management's assertions to us. It doesn't change our responsibility here in terms of what we need to do and execute on and to validate those assertions. But it is something that my profession thinks is important to share with the board. And that's it. So open to any questions. Yes, Jim.
One question about your opening comment.
Yes.
Are we to anticipate that there will be a turnover in the managing accountant partner for our audit purposes?
So the port goes through a required procurement process where the audit will be part of will be reevaluated this year. So I'm not going anywhere. We're bringing, you know, Ian, I just want to think about an orderly transition. It works best when we can have somebody shadow. It was a great opportunity to bring Ian in, and he's local, right? So it makes a lot of sense, but yeah. We'll work with management to figure out what the best thing is.
Okay. Yeah. Other questions, comments? Thanks very much.
Yeah, no, thank you again. Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
So, thanks, Cindy. We do have some consent items. And I first want to know if there's any commissioner that wants a presentation of the consent items. And they are as follows. Consent to expansion of the North Urban Clackamas County Enterprise Zone. Approval of adjustments to the appropriation levels for fiscal year 2016 and 17. And lease amendment, Con Global Industries, Inc., Rivergate Industrial District. All right, is there a motion and second for approval of the consent items?
So moved. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Opposed, carry. Thank you. And Darren, we're going to talk about the Motorola Solutions purchase.
Good morning.
Morning.
This item requests approval of a contract to purchase 126 Motorola radios and related radio equipment. The port has more than 600 radios, and more than 100 of those will no longer be supported in 2018. If we purchase the radios now, it will result in significant savings and also allow sufficient time to coordinate the programming needed to continue to operate on the City of Portland 800 megahertz radio system. Linda Dyson, Senior Manager of IT Operations, is here to provide project scope, background, and a recommendation to approve a contract to purchase the new equipment.
Thank you, Darren, and good morning.
Good morning.
As Darren mentioned, we're here to talk about a purchase for radio equipment from Motorola Solutions as a sole source provider for the city equipment. I'll briefly go over the project scope, budget, and timeline. So, as noted, this is a purchase of radios. These are handheld radios and or vehicle-mounted radios. Some backup and recording consolettes in the communication center that record the radio communications, and miscellaneous accessories. As you can see from the slide, the standard radio, pretty rugged device, is on the left, and the recording equipment is on the right. By way of background, the city is a user or subscriber. The port is a user or subscriber to the city's system along with all of the other local agencies. We use the system for our own communications and also for interagency communications in the event of emergency. For the past couple of years, the city has been undergoing a major upgrade of this 800 megahertz system from analog to digital. Motorola is the sole source provider for the equipment. The project is expected to end at the end of December, and through that time frame, Motorola is offering significant discounts to agencies if they purchase equipment now rather than later. The port's equipment, as Darren noted, is we have about 600 radios. 450 of them are already compliant with the new technology. We do have some radios that will end of support next year. We had originally planned to purchase the upgrades to those radios next year, but because of the savings provided through Motorola, we can save $350,000 on this radio purchase if we do this by the end of next year rather than waiting until next year. Project scope is the purchase of the radios and the consolettes for the comm center. Through a separate purchase, we will purchase some software so that our staff can do the programming for the radios. Right now, we send radios to the city of Portland to do the programming at a cost of about $200 each time we need to do that. Purchasing the software will allow us to do that, and we'll save that transport back and forth while we wait for the city to be available to do it. Project also includes installation of the recording equipment in the comm center and the coordination with our end users as we swap out those radios. The schedule, we've been in the planning process for a couple of months now. We are hoping for your approval of this purchase today. It takes about 2 months for the equipment delivery, and then we expect to take most of next year, 2017, for the equipment installation and transfer from older radios to newer radios. The overall capital budget is almost $950,000. This purchase is $663,700. We have some related services that we'll procure separately. There are port staff costs for the programming and the coordination. There's some contractor support for installation, and we've got about a 10% contingency. Because the radios are used across the port, the funding is divided between the different funds. So the biggest share is airport related. And then we do have general fund equipment for marine security and a couple of other facilities. With that, the staff requests the approval of the executive director's recommendation to award a contract to Motorola Solutions Incorporated in an amount not to exceed $663,700. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
How long has Motorola supported the current inventory of radios?
That's a good question. I think it's over 10 years.
Okay. And have there been recontracting during that period of time, or has that been a continuous?
So the city's contract with Motorola, it dates back at least 10 years. I think Mark knows the answer to that from the city. And they, when they pursued their radio upgrade, they contracted with Motorola specifically. Motorola is the only company that's compliant with the city's system that we use.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Is there a motion and second to approve the recommendation?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Cindy, I guess you're coming back. We're going to talk about big bond issuance.
Thank you. This agenda item requests approval to issue up to $285 million of Series 24 Portland International Airport revenue bonds. The bond proceeds will be used to fund capital projects in the airline cost center, make a deposit to the debt service reserve fund, capitalize interest, and pay for the cost of issuing the bonds. Lisa Fedeli, who's the Director of Financial Planning and Analysis, is here today to present this agenda item and request approval to enact Ordinance 459B, authorizing the issuance of the bonds.
Thanks, Cindy, and good morning.
Good morning.
This item requests approval for the issuance of the Series 24 Airport Revenue Bonds. I'll walk you through the actions requiring approval, the plan of finance, the timeline, and then I'll read the recommendation. Ordinance, the approval of Ordinance 459B would authorize the sale of up to $285 million of Series 24 Airport Revenue Bonds to fund capital projects in the Airline Cost Center. Bond proceeds, along with passenger facility charges and the federal grants that Bill mentioned earlier, would fully fund the Series 24 projects. The largest project to be financed is terminal balancing, the six-gate extension to Concourse E. Excuse me. The issuance also includes phase one of the replacement of passenger boarding bridges and the installation of port-owned preconditioned air units, improvements to concourse grease interceptors and HVAC, airfield rehabilitation projects for Taxiway B and the crosswind runway 321, conceptual design of the terminal core projects, and miscellaneous other projects. These project costs, along with capitalized interest, a deposit to the debt service reserve fund, and bond issuance costs, total to the not-to-exceed amount of $285 million. The bonds will be 30-year fixed-rate general airport revenue bonds with debt service repaid by the signatory airlines serving PDX. These are subordinate lien bonds. However, the subordinate lien is the most senior lien that the port has. There is currently $575 million in outstanding aviation bonds. This number is lower than what Bob had reported because we had principal payment on July 1st. In the current market, similarly rated airport issuers are seeing yields between 3.5% and 4%. There are many variables that can impact rates, however, such as yesterday's election, interest rate actions by the Federal Reserve, which may happen in December, as well as an issuer's bond rating. So this graph illustrates historical and forecasted balances in the Airline Cost Center Construction Fund and how bond issuances affect that cash balance. What the blue line shows is as the cash balance was dwindling in 2014, the Series 22 bonds were issued. Since that time, we've been closely monitoring the cash balance in order to prepare for when to issue the Series 24. The orange dotted line reflects what would happen to the cash balance if we were to not issue the Series 24 bonds. And the green dashed line reflects the issuance of the Series 24 bonds and how that balance gets spent down. As the chart indicates, it's likely we'd be back in the market with another bond issuance in 2018. So today, approval of the ordinance is requested. In December, we'll be meeting with Standard & Poor's to receive a rating. If it is deemed advantageous, we would consider obtaining a rating from a second rating agency that would be chosen as part of that decision. And then in January, we would price and close the bonds. So there are specific actions that need to take place. I was going to read the recommendation. The executive director recommends that Ordinance 459B in the form presented to commission be read in title only, that a public hearing be held prior to adopting Ordinance 459B, and that proposed Ordinance 459B in the form presented to the commission be enacted by a roll call vote, and that the executive director or his designee is authorized to execute the necessary documents on behalf of the commission in a form approved by council.
So before I open the public hearing, could you go back to the slide where you list the elements to the bond issuance?
Yes.
So I'm familiar with, and I assume others on the commission are, with all of the identified components of that, except the miscellaneous and other projects, and maybe we've heard about all of those as
sorry.
Well.
Oh, sorry. There were so many, I couldn't fit them all in one slide.
Yeah, and I don't mean for you to go through and
I have them
detail
right here.
Each of them, but if there's anything significant in that $17 million, it'd be nice to know what it is.
We have a central utility plant program to add chilled water. That was $9 million. On Concourse D, there's a $1 million project to put in an electrical room. And then there's a coalwood pipe project that would connect McBride Slough with Columbia Slough. Okay. And then there's a stormwater project, which would be the first of our stormwater projects.
Okay. Now, does anybody else have any questions about the items that are above that they are curious about? Okay. So are there any questions then other than that? I will open the public hearing. And it's a bit formulaic, but this is a public hearing on ordinance number 459B. Does any member of the public wish to be heard at this time? Okay. Then I'll close the public hearing and ask if you, Lisa, would read the ordinance 459B by title only.
Yes. The title is an ordinance authorizing the issuance and sale in one or more series of not more than $285 million aggregate principal amount of Portland International Airport revenue bonds to pay or reimburse the port for the payment of the costs of constructing, renovating, acquiring, equipping, and installing improvements at the Portland International Airport, and to pay costs related thereto, and to pay costs of issuing the bonds, including interest to accrue on all or a portion of the bonds, and to fund certain reserves, authorizing amendments to the Port's Airport Revenue Bond Ordinance Number 155 as amended, and Airport Revenue Bond Ordinance Number 323 as amended, authorizing and providing for related matters and documents. It's a mouthful.
Now I'd ask if there's a motion and second to approve the recommendation.
So moved. Second.
All those in favor?
We need a roll call vote.
Oh, I'm sorry. We do need a roll call vote.
Commissioners Alexander?
Aye.
Carter?
Aye.
Chamberlain?
Aye.
Kuprel Comas?
Aye.
Levy?
Aye.
McDonald?
Aye.
Saruta?
Aye.
And Young?
Aye.
Okay. Good. The motion carries. Uh-huh. And I think we can adjourn the meeting, correct?
Thank you.